This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. It's fun to play detective, read a mystery or see a film and try and figure out who the killer is. In Philadelphia, there's a group that regularly meets for lunch in an old Victorian dining room and tries to solve cold cases. But they aren't playing. The VDOC Society is a collection of detectives and forensic experts, some retired, who meet to discuss unsolved murders, usually brought to them by law enforcement officials looking for help. Over 20 years, they've helped police solve many crimes. The founders of the group are former FBI agent William Fleischer, Frank Bender, a world-renowned forensic artist and sculptor who's sadly dying of mesothelioma, and our guest Richard Walter, a nationally recognized criminal profiler. Walter is a forensic psychologist who worked for years in the Michigan prison system. He's examined countless crime scenes and interviewed thousands of felons. I spoke to Richard Walter along with Michael Capuzzo, who's written a book about the VDOC Society called The Murder Room. Michael Capuzzo has written for several newspapers and magazines and is the author of a previous book, Close to Shore. Well, Michael Capuzzo, Richard Walter, welcome to Fresh Air. Richard Walter, I thought we'd begin by talking about one of the cold cases that you looked at to get a sense of how you work. And I thought we might talk about the terrible case of a woman named Terry Lee Brooks, who was a night manager at a fast food restaurant, found murdered, safe was open, the police were stomped. Tell us about the crime.
The crime was committed inside the Roy Rogers restaurant. It was discovered when people came to work in the morning. The victim, the night manager, had been brutally murdered, had been manipulated in the sense of having saran wrap wrapped around her head, excessive violence to the body, as though it were just a catharsis of violence and venom against her. The safe had been manipulated. I think there was a belief that it was related to a possible robbery. When you looked at the body, when you looked at the crime scene itself, it was obvious that it was not a robbery.
Now, that's the interesting thing, because the local police were looking for a robbery suspect, right?
Yes.
What did you see that they didn't?
What robbery suspect is going to stab the victim so viciously that the knife enters the tile floor and wraps the head in cellophane? And body position, again, is important. Face up, face down, all these other sorts of things. A robber simply is not going to do that. It's not efficient. There's no efficacy or value in that kind of an activity. And so you have to look of how he spends his time and his interest by what's there as well as by what's not there. And I found then that the primary focus was an intense anger catharsis against the victim, that the staged robbery aspect was just a red herring created by the suspect to throw the police off, which it did.
So you developed an uncannily precise profile of who the suspect was. Who did you? What kind of person should they have been looking for?
Well, given the amount of violence at the scene and how it was personalized to the victim, this normally would not happen to a person that the victim did not know. Also, the victim had to let the suspect in. And so, therefore, the presumption is that she knew him. There is a presumption, obviously, that there's hostility, extreme hostility. And you see that he doesn't really care when the victim dies. He cares about when his anger has been sated. So as a consequence, then, already we know a great deal about him because of previous research done in the area of subtypes of murders. The anger retaliatory then have these characteristics. In fact, it was a textbook case for anger retaliatory. So it was simply a matter of watching and plugging in the bits and pieces along the way. In this case, then, it was reasonable to assume that a boyfriend may have been involved.
Richard actually predicted he'd be living with his mother and having a menial job, which was all right on target. But he'd also been spotted by another VDOC Society member as a name appearing on a funeral, the funeral register of his victim. And by the time he was caught. He had actually, the motive was that he was, they were engaged, and they had actually bought a wedding dress and made honeymoon plans, and she broke it off because she was looking for, you know, a more ambitious young man, and that was behind it too.
You know, in terms of looking at what is unseen at a crime scene, I thought I wanted to ask you, Richard Walter, about the case of a tragic murder of a Drexel University woman who was murdered in a laboratory late at night, right?
Yes.
Tell us what the police missed in that case.
Do you want me to describe in brief how the body was lying?
And then sure,
you
can, go ahead.
Yeah, is it just that she was a young blonde mathematics major at Drexel lying on her back in her 20s? She's been murdered. And she's got on – it's just before Thanksgiving. She's at the bottom of an outdoor stairwell of like a big classroom building. She's staying up past midnight working. She's still wearing her winter coat. She's still wearing her watch. She's wearing pants. There's no sign of sexual assault. And her socks and shoes are missing. Police can't get it for 7 years, and then enter the Vidocq Society and Richard.
When you're looking at a major violent crime, you look at what was the simplest thing to get done, what needed to be done, i.e., if the intent was to murder, then what was the simplest form? And anything past that then tells us about the perpetrator. And in this case, the extracurriculars were the shoes and socks. Well, I'm not naive in the sense of foot fetishes, shoe fetishes, et cetera. No other real options came forward. There was no other real explanations for the evidence or the lack of evidence of which they had.
You suggested, didn't you, that they ought to look into their primary suspect who they could never get a sort of handle on. He was a burly sort of Drexel guard. And Richard suggested he look into his army records. Perhaps there were issues with foot fetishism.
And there were.
Right. And eventually he was arrested and confessed to the murder, right?
Yes. And he had hundreds of women's shoes and whatever else. And he had, his wife also then said that he had a profound foot fetish issue. Historically, they many times do not end in murder. In this particular case, it did.
Do you often interview – when you're assisting a local police department, Richard Walter, do you often end up interviewing suspects themselves?
Occasionally, mostly by proxy. Sometimes on the request of the department, and if I'm comfortable with it, I will interview the suspect. Most of the time, I give advice to the detectives then on how to approach and what is probably going to be their primary three strategies that they may want to consider for that particular kind of murder, given the class and the level and the sophistication of the suspect.
Can you think of a case where your intervention in that interview mattered?
Yes. I'm not sure how far I want to go into this, but yes. Well, I could liken it to the case that we talked about earlier. In terms of interviewing an anger retaliatory type, one of the things that must be understood by the detectives is, contrary to popular opinion, the perpetrator does not feel any guilt for committing the killing. In point of fact, when they leave the killing site, they many times have a sense of well-being and a sense of relief and sense of charm because they've just had 50 pounds of emotional baggage taken off their shoulders. Police don't expect that. Equally, when it then comes then to an interview, and whether by wit or skill, and many officers have a lot of skill, they may get the guy into a frame where he's re-angry at the victim, is recounting it, and he senses and feels that the guy is just about ready to confess. And so he comes to his aid and says, "And so therefore, you were so mad, you just killed her, and now you feel bad." And it's just like throwing cold water on an interview. You never, never, never would do that.
Gives the power back to the perpetrator.
Exactly.
And as you've pointed out to me, and the worst thing to do is to show him the butchered body and say, "Don't you feel terrible that you did this to this woman?"
Exactly. Those are just no-nos. And so you guard against that, and then you aim toward facilitating then those things that a guilty person would use and become identified with and confess.
And just to follow that up for a second, so you're getting close. You don't show them the pictures of the body. You don't try and make them feel sorry for it. They don't. What instead brings you the confession?
anger that she deserved it.
Reproduced the anger that led to the killing, right?
Yes.
Right.
And
So what kind of question would elicit that?
Well, she rejected you. She didn't want you. She told you to get out of her life. She dismissed you like a small child, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but obviously much more intense, where even your own mother, you know, says that you're a failure. And so now it's just not the victim, but it's women in general, that group that he relies on is trying to exploit. In the course of events, then he's going to come to the conclusion, if he's wrapped up into it, he's going to come to the conclusion that's what they were doing. And yes, and by God, she deserved it. And I gave it to her. And I'm happy. Thank you very much. Do I want to go to jail? No. But she deserved it.
Michael Capuzzo, let's talk about this group of investigators, the VDOC Society. Who's in it? What are the rules?
Well, the VDOC Society was founded by Richard Walter, the forensic psychologist and profiler, and his friends Bill Fleischer, who is the commissioner and is the leader of the society. He's a former FBI agent and a sort of tough-nosed Philadelphia private eye. And Frank Bender, who's the world's most famous, if not most gifted, forensic artist. And the three of them were having lunch in 1990 and bemoaning the rise of murder all across, murder rates all across the country. And they had the idea that they wanted to get together over lunch. Actually, it started socially and evolved into a club of great detectives and great forensic specialists from around the world who meet once a month, the third Thursday of every month, in an old Victorian dining room in Philadelphia, men and women, and solve murders over lunch or begin to examine them over lunch. And then when passion grows and relationships are formed between great detectives like Richard and say, you know, a Kansas Bureau of Investigations agent who needs help on a cold murder case he can't get his hands around. Well, then Richard, for instance, in the Texas case, went out and spent 6 years and 6,000 hours pro bono putting a killer in jail. So they're a crime-fighting pro bono organization of real characters and they would like to be around.
Now, are there rules about who gets to present a case to the VDOC Society?
The rules in general are that the VDOC Society makes every effort to stay in the background and be an assistant to law enforcement. So they will not engage or consider any cold case unless it's at least 2 years old. And they will not consider a cold case unless it's an innocent victim. In other words, a drug dealer who's been murdered, and even if his mother's upset, is not going to get an audience before the VDOC Society. And after that, it's whoever they think they can help and whoever they think they're interested in helping.
All right. And it's not a case where they're butting into local law enforcement typically, right? You will have local law enforcement will come and actually make a presentation over lunch. Is that the way it works?
Yes. Like in the case you brought up, the Falls Township or Police Department made a presentation. There were friendships between former Philadelphia police officers and some there at the Falls Township. And they come to lunch and they have a PowerPoint presentation. And it's white, round tables and white tablecloths. And the lunch is served. And then in about the fourth or fifth course, up comes the corpse on the PowerPoint and the lights go down. And there's a real exchange. The detective, cold case detective from the police department or the, federal or local or state will stand at a podium and run through the case and then ask for questions and help. And there's a close relationship and interchange.
And give us a sense. Now, we know that the former FBI agent William Fleischer is involved. Richard Walter, who's with us in this interview, is there. And then the sketch artist, Frank Bender. What are some of the other criminal investigative skills that are represented in the society?
It's a tremendous range. I think of it as CSI to the 10th power, but real. I mean, they have other profilers in addition to Richard, like Robert Ressler, the great former FBI agent, Interpol and the director of Sûreté, a captain from the Egyptian army, experts in white-collar crime and terrorism and sadism and even a psychic, pathologists and, the bread-and-butter stuff of criminal investigation.
Richard Walter, I wanted to talk a little bit about the kinds of killers that you have seen over the years. What kind of killer covers the eyes of his victims?
Anger retaliatory.
Meaning what?
Meaning that they're out of anger, out of an intense anger, they're reacting to a perceived real or manufactured slight that they believe that the victim created against them. Therefore, then they aggress and they destroy. They don't care when the victim dies. They care when they're satisfied. They do not feel guilty. They cover the eyes because they don't want the victim, even in death, to be looking at them as they walk out the door. They try to eclipse that from them. And they feel good after the murder. They historically have a sense of well-being for about 45 minutes to an hour and a half. And then they have different plots past that point in terms of the investigation.
You've written there are three other types of killers: the power reassurance killer, the anger, the power assertive killer, the anger excitation killer. We won't go over them all. But one of the things that struck me was that you wrote in this book that you have to be careful what you say and write, because sadists are the first ones who will attend your lectures and order reprints of your papers. How do you know that?
True. Because they do. In fact, I think Mike even included in the book a story that I told him that years ago I was in Kansas City, or Topeka rather, at a conference. And I had been at the police department and was taken back then to go up and give a lecture on sadism. And the detective who had been with me earlier in the day and showed me a suspect in a murder case came up to me just before I went up on the platform, and he said, you know that guy? He said, I pointed out to you at the police department. And I said, yes. And he said, I just flushed him out of your audience. And I said, oh, okay. And I've had other places where if I'm lecturing, for instance, on rape or whatever else, that rapist will sneak into the audience. It's not just myself, but Bob Ressler has had the same thing.
He's the FBI profiler, right?
Right.
But tell me, what is it you think that they're there for? What is it that you're – that might they learn that troubles you?
If I then show them the learning curve for sadism and they understand its direction and its power, then – they can try to manipulate that and make it more complex. And I think it's complex enough, and I don't want to interfere the investigation in any further. And I think it furthers their pathology, actually. And so good people are supposed to be stopping them, and we don't want to make them more efficient at knowing how we're going to do it.
You said
Richard doesn't.
Yeah, go ahead, Mike. Look up.
Richard doesn't want to become, if I might, their Dr. Frankenstein. I mean,
yeah.
I was fascinated by the whole notion that there's this downward growth. Like we think of an upward growth toward God or whatever, you know, goodness, whatever we perceive as a personality growth. And this inexorable downward growth that Richard has identified sort of right to hell. And he becomes – he doesn't want – I think I would interpret it as to be – for him to become their interpreter, their coach, their doctor.
Right.
Richard Walter, you've spent most of your life doing this. You're not married, right?
Not anymore.
What kind of person does it take to do what you do well?
I wouldn't encourage anybody who I loved to follow in my footsteps.
Why?
There's a price to pay. I'm willing to pay it. I would much rather encourage people to develop healthy families, relationships, enjoy the beach. And yes, can I do all that too? Yes. But I think that I've come out reasonably well. But if you haven't figured it out by now, there are those of my friends who might even say I'm a little eccentric.
You know, eccentricity doesn't seem such a terrible price. What is the price you think you pay for doing this well?
Loss of innocence. You say, if I do my job well, there's going to be somebody in the society who maybe I can protect that doesn't have to learn all the evils that there are, that they can go ahead and they can live their life and they can go to the theater and they can go to the art and they can live the quality of life that I think that all of us would like. But sometimes along the way, there are those people, and I'm probably one of them, who then see that life just doesn't always happen that way. And so therefore, sometimes somebody has to make the investment into how do we protect people that is the most efficient. And so sometimes we we pay the price.
Well, Richard Walter, Michael Capuzzo, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
Richard Walter is a forensic psychologist and a founding member of the VDOC Society. Writer Michael Capuzzo's book about the society is called The Murder Room. You can read an excerpt at our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. The Gulf oil spill was a sober warning about the risks involved in extracting oil and gas from deposits miles under the Earth's surface in increasingly remote locations, and another reminder that our dependence on fossil fuels comes with a price. Months before the Deepwater Horizon burned and sank in the Gulf, our guest Peter Moss wrote a book arguing that our relentless pursuit of diminishing oil stocks has visited a host of evils on the world, especially in the countries that hold the deposits we crave. Moss argues that in many developing countries, oil breeds corruption, heightens social divisions, increases violence, and degrades the environment. Peter Moss is a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. He's written for several other national publications and has reported from the Middle East, Asia, South America, and Africa. His book is now out in paperback. It's called Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. Peter Moss, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's talk about Equatorial Guinea. It's a tiny country in West Africa that most people couldn't locate on a map. Tell us just a bit about the country, its size, its geography.
Equatorial Guinea is in the Gulf of Guinea, not far from Cameroon and Nigeria. And it's a tiny little country, 500,000 people, if that, and basically was ignored for the world for quite a long time. It used to be a Spanish colony, got independent in the 1960s, and then was presided over by a really ruthless dictator who basically committed genocide there and forced out or killed about a third of his population. In 1979, this dictator was overthrown by his nephew, Theodore Obiang, who then had his uncle executed in a show trial. And after 1979, Obiang ran the country in a very dictatorial fashion. Nobody seemed to care because it was such a small country. But then in the early 1990s, an American exploration company found commercially viable deposits of oil in Equatorial Guinea's waters in the Gulf of Guinea, and thus began kind of a new chapter in this country's history, a chapter that involved a heck of a lot of attention from particularly American oil companies.
And the interesting thing about the country geographically is that the capital is actually on an island, right? And then there's a little spit of land on the African mainland, right?
Exactly. The capital, Malabo, is on an island called Bioko, and that's the capital. And the mainland, which is a very small portion of territory, is kind of scrunched between Gabon and Cameroon. So you have a strange sort of political situation where the government resides offshore, quite literally speaking, but the largest piece of its territory is onshore. But that, you know, in and of itself isn't kind of the major problem associated with Equatorial Guinea. I mean, the problem was that it had no history of democracy or anything close to that. And then once it discovered oil, all of the oil reserves, all of the revenues that came in were basically under the control of the country's leader, Theodore Obiang.
Yeah, tell us about Theodore Obiang and his relationship with the oil companies there.
Theodore Obiang had, for a dictator, a wonderful relationship with these oil companies. They wanted to get at his oil. They were willing to pretty much do whatever he wanted to have done in the way of payments or whatnot. So the first batch of revenues over a couple of years, about $700 million of revenue, were deposited into secret bank accounts at Riggs Bank in Washington, D.C. As well, Obiang, for purposes of what we believe is personal enrichment, had all these side deals with these oil companies where they would rent buildings and land from relatives of his for extraordinary amounts of money. So, you know, a 14-year-old nephew of the president's, for example, was the legal owner and received revenues of several hundred thousand dollars from one of these oil companies. So it was a period of marvelous enrichment for him that kind of was blown up in about 2000, 2001 when it was discovered that these accounts existed. Riggs Bank had not been filing suspicious activity reports, even though in some cases there was one of the Riggs Bank officials who would go to the Equatorial Guinean embassy in Washington, D.C. and pick up suitcases of cash and deposit them into the bank. And around 2000, 2001, this was discovered and kind of the hatch was blown off of that. But it didn't really change things in the country itself because Obiang remained the most powerful, the most wealthy, elections were pretty much of a joke. I mean, I think in the ones that began this decade, he won about 99% of the popular vote. And then in the election that occurred just last year, he won about 97% of the popular vote. And he's not that popular of a dictator.
You traveled to Equatorial Guinea. To tell us about what you saw. I mean, surely there's enough wealth coming in from the oil revenue to both make the president and his family happy and, you know, at least build some roads, bridges, schools, hospitals. What did you see?
My visit to Equatorial Guinea was a couple of years ago. So things have developed slightly since then in terms of more in the way of infrastructure, according to the people that I've been in touch with about conditions in the country now. Nonetheless, it remains a country where health, education, welfare indicators are really at the bottom of the rung for Africa, even though on a per capita basis, if like all the oil revenue were shared equally amongst all the people of Equatorial Guinea, it would be one of the richest countries, not just in Africa, but perhaps in the world. And so you have when you go there, when I went there, for example, you know, kind of rutted streets, very bad infrastructure, schools that had no books, not even schools in most villages, hospitals, for example. I went to one major town on the mainland and they had one hospital and it basically just had a little bit of aspirin and that was pretty much it. It was a place not for people to be cured, but for people to go and die. And you also still have this very dictatorial situation. I mean, I lasted in Equatorial Guinea for just a week, at the end of which I was expelled on charges of being a spy.
Now, I imagine the oil companies, they certainly are under no illusions that Teodoro Obiang is you know, a democratic leader. They don't know what he's about. And I suppose what they would say is, look, we don't make the rules. If we have a product that there's a market for, and if we want to do business here, we play by the rules that the local authorities set for us. To what extent are they responsible for or complicit in the kind of corruption that you see?
Well, they have to play not just by the rules of the local government, but also obviously the ones that prevail in the United States of America as well. And so that's why you've seen a number of companies, for example, in Nigeria, there was a major scandal over a natural gas facility that was built by a consortium of companies that included Halliburton and other Western companies that were exposed for being involved in massive amounts of corruption, and they were brought to book for it. So when you're in these countries, you can't just say, well, you know, the local dictators asked us for this money or this is the way it operates here. You do have to obey American laws, too. They do have a point, though, when they say, you know, look, what do you want us to do? We can't, you know, be agents of political change, et cetera. And what they also say, and this was great, there was this one American oil executive I talked to or write about in the book who was actually convicted for tax fraud related to payoffs that he apparently had received while negotiating contracts on behalf of Mobil. And he said to me, look, you know, if you only want us to get oil and gas from London and Paris because laws there are nice and there's not so much bribery, okay, fine. But then we're going to be stepping over manure in the streets of New York City. The point that he was making and that a lot of people in the industry make, and it doesn't exonerate them, but it certainly kind of gives you some sort of context. They're saying, look, we're just doing what the American government wants us to do, what the American consumer wants us to do. If you don't want us to go to these fairly nasty places and do business there, business in a way that might enrich or enhance dictatorships, fine. But then oil, instead of costing $2.50 at the pump, is going to cost $5 at the pump. Now, this doesn't, I think, exonerate them because they still have a moral responsibility, if not a legal responsibility, to act in ways that do not harm the countries that they're operating in. But it does also kind of, I think, make us broaden the spotlight away from them or just outside of them and also to our own government and also to ourselves.
Now, in Equatorial Guinea, you have a situation where you have a dictator who rules the country with an iron fist. You also write about Nigeria, which is, of course, a much larger country in West Africa with large oil deposits and operations. But there's been a lot of tribal strife and civil armed conflict there. What's been the effect of oil production and oil wealth on those conflicts?
Well, Nigeria has just been devastated by oil. In the early 1960s, when Nigeria became independent from British rule and when also it discovered commercially viable amounts of oil, it was actually a very promising country. I mean, it had an educated elite. It had a good farming sector. It had the beginnings of a good manufacturing sector. And quite quickly, the country went into a tailspin. And it's not just because of oil. I mean, we have to kind of be clear about this. You know, when something goes bad in a country where the country is a major oil producer, it's not necessarily all kind of accounted to by oil. There are other factors involved. Nigeria kind of obviously was inherently fragile in the sense of it was composed of a lot of different racial ethnic groups, and religious groups that were going to cause problems anyways. But there was, of course, the Biafran War in Nigeria, which was partly related to oil and control over oil resources, though that wasn't the only consideration by far. But then once that was over, you had this period in the 1970s or whatever when all this oil money was pouring into Nigeria, and it really wasn't trickling down. I mean, so much of it was actually just being diverted into foreign bank accounts of government officials or local bank accounts of smaller-level officials that were corrupt at the local level in Nigeria. And so what you had is a country that actually, after 30 years of oil extraction by the late 1990s, people realized that Nigeria, generally speaking, had become poorer since it found oil. So you had a country that was devastated economically and politically because the political culture in Nigeria just became, you know, a kind of carnival of corruption. You had a series of military dictators, most well-known of all, Sani Abacha, who died with several $1 billion in offshore bank accounts. And so you had a country that was really quite devastated by this legacy of oil extraction to the point where now you've had for kind of the last decade in the Niger Delta, which is the heart of the oil-producing region in Nigeria, a kind of undeclared civil war going on over control of these resources because the people who actually live where the resources are based rather than profiting from them end up suffering the very most. And in the Niger Delta, the people there have truly, you know, had their fisheries devastated, their farmland devastated. And so they've had a series of rebellions, began peacefully but became violent. So now it's extremely dangerous to travel around there. Oil extraction continues. Oil pollution has just been tremendously awful there because of the incredibly difficult conditions in which the companies operate. They probably shouldn't even be operating there, but they do. And so the result, and I went into the Niger Delta, is that it's, you know, kind of a wasteland of violence and failed state conditions where you don't have much in the way of government activity other than army activity against local people in many parts of the Delta.
We should talk about BP. It sort of underwent a transformation in the mid-90s. Tell us about that.
Well, BP underwent a, I think we can now assert, rhetorical transformation. In the mid-1990s, when it had then a new chief executive, John Brown, it began a really aggressive expansion, and it became kind of, instead of a second-level oil company, really one of the world's largest oil companies. And John Brown, the chief executive at the time, was celebrated for that. I mean, he had taken this kind of so-so oil company and really made it kind of a top player in terms of reserves, in terms of profitability, production, et cetera. And then around 2000, somewhere around there, he kind of embarked on a new fold of activity, which was to make British Petroleum the greenest oil company around. And the transformation that kind of he embarked on was to kind of do away with British Petroleum, even as the title of the company, just have it be BP and have it stand for Beyond Petroleum. There was a certain amount of skepticism over whether or not John Brown and BP were as green as they said they were, but John Brown did go out and say he was more or less in favor of Kyoto Protocols, and he was one of the first major oil executives to admit that global warming was happening and was the result of human activity, particularly the burning of fossil fuels. So he was quite unusual in that regard in the oil industry, but you know, there were questions at the time. Okay, this is very nice rhetoric, but how is this company actually operating? Is it really operating in a way that's different from the oil companies, the other ones?
And what was the company's record on environmental responsibility, on safety, integrity after this transformation?
Well, it rapidly emerged that BP really wasn't any different and, in fact, might not have been even as good in terms of actual environmental operations as its main competitors. There was in 2005 an explosion at a BP refinery in Texas City that killed, I believe it was 15 workers, and injured many more. And the investigations that then occurred afterwards revealed that this explosion was the result of the plant being run with very small budgets, very little in investments in new equipment. Worker safety was not terribly well followed at this place. And it was all the result of a really kind of harsh cost-cutting plan that the company had overall to increase its profitability. And so this was, you know, necessarily and obviously quite a black eye for the company. And then also there was a major kind of pipeline problem up in the North Slope of Alaska, where BP is a major operator. A lot of oil was spilled from its pipelines, which subsequent investigations revealed were badly maintained and were had to actually be shut down because they were in such dire need of maintenance and repairs. And then you had actually around the same time, too, you had a trading scandal in which BP traders were found to have been planning the manipulation of propane markets in America. So it rapidly became quite clear that there was a lot of smoke, a lot of mirrors, but really not much in the way of different behavior and, in fact, maybe even worse behavior by BP, despite the rhetoric of being beyond petroleum and being a green oil company.
I'm interested in your evaluation of their response to the Gulf spill and whether it would have been any different if it were in another company.
Well, their response, their initial response was to downplay the extent of the accident, to try to keep information about the accident away. Quite famously, the video feeds that BP had access to from their submersible robots were not made available to the public or even to Congress until the company was forced to make them available. And so you had a company that was incredibly intransparent, that was trying to downplay and keep people away from the truth about what was happening. And, you know, one of the things that's been interesting about kind of not only what BP did after the accident, but the reaction to it is that the reaction seems to have been BP's a rotten apple. That, you know, look, the company lied when this accident happened. The company was incredibly reckless in its management of the Deepwater Horizon rig, and that's why the accident happened. It's a rogue. But actually, as terrible as the company's behavior has been, you know, in my opinion, it's not necessarily that much different from what might have been the case with other oil companies. Because, you know, we need to keep remember, I think, that quite famously, you know, this repair plan that BP had or damage control plan in terms of cleaning up any accident in the Gulf of Mexico included caring for the walruses that were in the Gulf of Mexico and included kind of the phone number and name of a disaster expert who actually was dead. And this was kind of used to show how, you know, kind of BP hadn't planned at all and wasn't terribly responsive to the needs of and to its responsibilities. But then it emerged that actually Exxon and other companies had the exact same disaster recovery type plan, also mentioned walruses, which do not, of course, exist in the Gulf of Mexico, also mentioned the same dead disaster expert. So I think that was really interesting evidence of how, although BP provably has a worse environmental and safety record than, for example, Exxon, nonetheless, the other companies are still in the same league in terms of generally speaking, how they operate, how they would operate, how well they had planned or not well planned for a disaster of this sort.
You know, it's interesting. The last chapter of your book, the one which deals with solutions, is pretty short because you say it's not like there's any great mystery about a lot of this. We need to cut our dependence. We need to look for alternative energy sources. But you do have one other notion, and that is new transparency in oil contracts, that there is a movement afoot to make the financial arrangements surrounding oil extraction public. Tell us about that.
This is actually something that whenever you feel pessimistic about the possibilities of change and good things happening, that now one can point to and actually kind of realize, hey, that there are things happening that are hopeful. Because one of the ways to diminish the problematic aspects of oil in the sense of the corruption that it can enhance and nurture is to just have transparency. If people know how much is being paid for contracts, what the contracts are, where the money is going, et cetera, then it's harder for corrupt rulers to steal. It's harder for companies to bribe. And also the money that is then kind of known to be flowing one way or the other will be used in a better fashion because people will know how it's being spent and won't be spent on ridiculous projects or whatever. And about 2 years ago, there was a bill that was proposed in the U.S. Congress called the Energy Security Through Transparency Act, which would require every extractive company, not just in the oil industry, but also coal and other extractive industries, to publish all the payments that they make to foreign governments for the resources that they extract. And, you know, of course, this bill went nowhere in the first year. This is part of the whole transparency movement that began really not so long ago. But actually, and this is quite a wonderful thing that just happened in the financial reform bill that passed Congress just quite recently, at the last minute, at the 11th hour, that bill, the transparency bill, was kind of attached to the Financial Reform Act. And so now, actually, all extractive industry companies that are registered with the SEC, that's not just American companies, that's also most of the world's extractive companies, are going to have to publish if they want to abide by SEC laws and continue operating in American jurisdiction. They're going to have to publish what they pay to all these foreign governments for their extractive activities. And that's really a quite marvelous and unexpected breakthrough. It's not going to end corruption. I mean, corruption is, you know, one of the oldest endeavors in human history, perhaps. But it's going to make it a lot more difficult for companies and for countries to be corrupt. It's going to give civic groups a lot more information to make sure that oil is not the curse that it might have been up until now. So it's easy to be pessimistic these days because, you know, the world's a complicated place and there are a lot of bad things going on. But, you know, just this one little act here, which is so new that nobody really knows kind of what its impact truly is going to be, could be quite a big deal.
Well, Peter Musk, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Peter Musk's book is called Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. It's now out in paperback, and you can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. The new film Scott Pilgrim vs. the World stars Michael Cera as a Canadian slacker who plays in a rock and roll band and does battle with his girlfriend's ex-boyfriends in the style of a video game hero. It's based on a series of graphic novels. Critic David Edelstein has this review.
In the films of British director Edgar Wright, there's a fluid connection between real life and the trashiest pop culture. His Shaun of the Dead was a zombie rehash, but Wright used all those borrowed tropes to satirize provincial English complacency in a way that had never been done. Now, in the comedy Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, Wright uses a series of Canadian graphic novels by Brian Lee O'Malley as a springboard for showing how rock and roll and video games fuel the most outrageous fantasies, even in the most mundane places. O'Malley's Scott Pilgrim vs. the World centers on a 20-something, down-and-out Toronto bass player, played on screen by Michael Cera. Most of the time, Scott shares a mattress in a crummy one-room dive with a gay friend, played with sly understatement by Kieran Culkin, and he dates a high school girl named Knives Chow, played by the buoyant Ellen Wong. Then he falls for Mary Elizabeth Winstead's magenta-haired punk rollerblader Ramona Flowers and learns that he might soon be besieged by her jealous exes.
If we're going to date, you may have to defeat my seven evil exes.
You have seven evil ex-boyfriends?
Seven evil exes, yes.
And I have to fight?
Defeat.
Defeat your seven evil exes if we're going to continue to date?
Pretty much.
So what you're saying right now is we are dating?
I guess.
Does that mean we can make out?
Sure.
Cool.
That mix of the deadpan and the outlandish is Scott Pilgrim vs. the World at its best. Seven evil exes? Well, yes. They appear one by one in the rock clubs where Scott and his band are playing. And suddenly, with no explanation, Scott transforms into a superhero, a flying, kung fu fighting rock and roll warrior. People blast one another with death rays and fling one another through walls. And in several scenes, the screen splits horizontally. Scott rockets from right to left on top, while his adversary barrels from left to right below. Crazy as all this is, there's a level on which it does connect with Scott's emotional reality, with the feeling of transcendence he has on stage playing bass, a bass that here throws bolts at the sky. At first, the crazy quilt inventiveness of Wright's movie is elating. It has a look all its own, part comic book panel, part arcade video game screen from the era of Pac-Man and Space Invaders. Even the Universal Pictures logo is rendered as a crude arcade game. Fun facts and character IDs pop up. When Scott and Ramona smooch, pink hearts float out of the screen. Scott Pilgrim vs. the World could have been among the coolest movies ever made. but it runs down. The parade of supervillain exes, among them Chris Evans, Brandon Routh, and Jason Schwartzman as their evil overlord, is like a forced march. I felt I'd had my fill of the fights, and there were still five exes to go. But the biggest problem is, alas, Scott Pilgrim. Michael Cera dials down his patented high-pitched hysteria, but our superhero is still a super cipher. That might work if the disjunction between his wishy-washiness and his powers were played for satire. But it's just a disjunction. He doesn't earn those powers, and he certainly doesn't earn the dishy Ramona, who inspires the film's most lyrical sight gag when she heads off into the night and the snow glows and melts under her rollerblades. Director Edgar Wright has done thrilling work, but he can't find here the connection between life and pop that he found in his other films. Scott Pilgrim doesn't seem lit from within. He's a superhero for dim bulbs.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can see clips from Scott Pilgrim vs. the World and download podcasts of our show at our website, freshair.npr.org. And you can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air.